You know, we spend a lot of time thinking about cyber as a technical problem, but have we ever thought about it as a behavioral problem? I have a PhD coming on the show who's going to give you some great insight into that. Stick around. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast to provide you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. I'm your host, G. Mark Hardy, and today I have Dr. Dustin Sachs on me with the show to talk about human behavior. Dustin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, G. Mark. It's great to be here. Been a big fan, you know, long-time listener, first-time caller kind of thing, you know, real big fan of CISO Tradecraft.
Well, I ran into you in Orlando. I think it was InfoSec World.
Yes.
And you did a talk that was fascinating. And afterwards, you were handing out some copies of your books called Behavioral Insights in Cybersecurity. And me being me, you know, the captain always eats last, I decided to wait to see if everybody else who wanted one got one. They did. So I did not have a chance to read your book cover to cover, but I think it'd be good insight. But before I start pitching your book, let's talk a little bit about what it is you do. I mean, you've got a doctorate in cybersecurity, and there's more people doing that, but there haven't been a lot of them. And so I always admire somebody when they've got the resilience to do that. But tell me a little bit about your background. You know, where are you coming from, and what are you doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started out in computer forensics in the very, very early days of computer forensics. Did a lot of work around theft of trade secrets during the economic downturn in 2008, 2009. A lot of people walking out the door with data that they had been generating over, you know, multiple years and decades of experience. And when they, you know, when the economy turned downward in 2008, they said, cool, I'm taking all this with me. I then got into a lot more of the incident response side of things because for me, I've always been really fascinated with puzzles and, you know, and identifying, you know, trying to catch people and, you know, understand how people operate. And that's where I think a lot of my fascination with the way that the human mind and the way that people work really came from. I remember having a boss who would regularly tell me when I'm doing a forensic investigation to think like the bad guy. If you were going to do this, how would you do it? And that mindset started to really build in me, and it started to build a fascination in the mindset of not only the attackers, but the mindset I needed to be in to think like an attacker. I then kind of shifted and decided that I really wanted to get more in-house, get out of the consulting world, and really help organizations from the inside. Spent some time in a cybersecurity operations center, which I think everybody in their career should do for at least 6 months just to appreciate the pain that is being a SOC analyst. I have a special place in my heart for SOC analysts because if there's something more demoralizing to do in cybersecurity, I would challenge somebody to come up with it.
CISO.
Okay, fine, you win. But SOC analyst is probably a close second. And, you know, then I moved into the GRC space and worked my way up to being the deputy CISO for a global fuel services organization. And it was there that I started to really see how behavioral science and how our decision making really happens, because I would give scenarios, vendor scenarios, third-party risk scenarios to my team, and I'd get very different answers from each person, and that didn't work with my forensics mind because the scenario wasn't changing. So what was changing? And at about that time, this was right as we were coming out of the pandemic, so 2022-ish, I said, you know, I see a gap in the knowledge and in the body of knowledge, and that is kind of that key word that you hear with people who are going to get their doctorate is adding to the body of knowledge. And I wanted to add to the body of knowledge. So I wanted to really investigate this in a formal sense. And it just became a rabbit hole. And, you know, now I consume information about how do we make decisions. Lately, I was just telling somebody the other day, lately, I've been really fascinated with the way the different brain chemicals work in our brain, dopamine, cortisol, all of those things that really make us do the things we do as humans, and how can we not demonize people or you know, yell at them for their humanity and for what they do, but understand it and almost hack people's brains to do things the way we need them to do it.
Interesting. So it goes beyond just simply providing direction or even providing motivation, but really trying to, from a leadership perspective, understand your people better, and what drives them, what makes them tick.
I mean, it's as simple as understanding that there is a truly chemical reaction in our brain when we click a link. You know, when you click a link in an email, you're getting a little shot of dopamine, and that dopamine makes your brain do things and think things that it wouldn't normally do, and it gives a sense of excitement that causes you to act at times irrationally. And understanding that process and understanding how to interrupt that process can be a very interesting thing. And from a leadership standpoint, it's super fascinating.
Yeah, I think what we find then, and that's, we look at kids and some recent legislative changes, for example, Australia saying essentially no screen time for your kids. It's like, what are they going to do? They got some very expensive calculators now because they can't go ahead and get online with them. But the point is that they're recognizing that, as you had said, that chemical feedback loop, that dopamine hit, like, ooh, wow, click on this, click on this, click on this, which is really, in a way, if we look at something such as the TikTok and the concern about their algorithms, it wasn't so much that it was measuring the chemicals in your brain, but rather it was some clever engineering that allowed you to go ahead and capture the data of, if this person watches this and then they watch that, they're going to watch three or four more things like this. And so we were able to continue that chain. And given enough data, you can usually figure out what those chains are going to look like. But I think it's interesting because from your perspective, it's not just the big vendors are going to take advantage of that, but I would suggest that as chief information security officers, we can find ways to align tasks and jobs and things like that that would more likely resonate with the individuals. Now, I understand that you have, at least on your page, your Myers-Briggs type.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So that was an interesting one because, I've taken Myers-Briggs at multiple points, and every time it seems to come back about the same. I'm definitely a very introverted person normally, which I think is the case with a lot of people in cyber. But then when you get in into your industry, into your niche, you become very extroverted because you're comfortable with it. So for me, it was really fascinating because I had come up through my career, and when you're in consulting, they do Myers-Briggs for you almost every year, I feel like. And so I had convinced myself I was this introverted person. And then I was like, I had somebody did an analysis for me of the things I was posting on LinkedIn and said, actually, here is your public persona. And it was very different. And I had to stop at first and go, well, wait a second, but that's not who I am. And then I looked at it and I was like, but that actually is who I am, because I try to be very authentic when I post stuff. I post things about the things that are interesting to me, you know, the things that I'm learning to help others. And it was very interesting to realize that while there are elements of the Myers-Briggs that for me were very much true, you know, I'm very focused on rules and justice and equity and, you know, doing the right thing and being thorough and being very detail-oriented, that introvert-extrovert thing was really interesting. And, you know, I see so many CISOs who will stand up and say, I'm an introvert. And I go, I'm not sure that you really are, because you're very outspoken, and it's an interesting kind of paradox and dichotomy.
It is. I've used Myers-Briggs over the years. I remember I did my first one in the Navy many years ago and typed out ENTJ, and I've pretty much been that my whole life and career. And I remember looking up in the book, it says, yeah, describes that commandant, takes charge of environment. Like, yeah, my blind spot is I tend to just go ahead and take control rather than work out the details of, you know, maybe let somebody else could do that. So it comes with positives and negatives. But the whole thing about Myers-Briggs, and that's not what the show's about, is it's a preference. And right. So when I get into the extrovert introvert stuff, what I found is the best describer of how to analyze yourself. Is not, are you a public persona? Have you got 263 podcasts that are out there, or do you go do a lot of public speaking or whatever? But how do you make decisions, and where do you draw your energy? So if you are the last person to leave a party because you're the guy dancing on the table with a lampshade on your head or whatever, you're probably an extrovert. If you like to just kind of be on your own, if you recharge with your private time rather than recharge by throwing yourself into a whole bunch of people, you're likely an introvert. And if you turn to an awful lot of other people to try to give them insights to say, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? What should I do? You're trying to crowdsource some of your decision-making. I would say you're more of an extrovert. If you sit there quietly and say, this is what I'm doing, more of an introvert. And those are completely decoupled from what you just described, which is your public persona, or you even play a public persona, because that's the role that we pick on. And ultimately, these are just personal preferences. They are not things that circumscribe your abilities or your talents. It's not like saying you're 5 foot tall, you're probably not going to make it in the NBA as a center. All right, that's just sort of a hard...
I don't know. Muggsy Bogues did pretty well as a short guy in the NBA, you know?
Yeah, the guard.
He also did have, you know, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, you know, other guys like right next to him to help him out as well. But, you know...
Well, since most of us are not going to work with a Michael Jordan or a Scottie Pippen, let's go back and think about in the business environment. Now, one of the things that we talked about is that when you look at, let's say, business initiative, we want to go ahead and we come with a great plan. We scope it out. We go talk to vendors. We get a budget. We get management approval. We get this thing on a timeline. We set up the Gantt charts. We're all locked and loaded and ready to go. What's my success rate once I've done all that stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there was some research done in late 2024 by McKinsey that found that actually 70% of digital transformation efforts, and specifically around security initiatives, fail because of a cultural gap. The organization believes that the culture of the organization is one thing, but the reality is, you know, humans are humans. Humans do human things. Humans are going to take the path of least resistance, and not because they're trying to be malicious. There was a another study that was done by Gartner that found that 70% of employees bypass controls just to get their job done, just to do their job better or more efficiently. So, you know, and so much of what we do in security is you need to meet our standard. You need to come to do what we want you to do, instead of really looking at it and going, how can I make my strategy work in this environment? You know, I use a very simple example. I have a 13-year-old son. When he was younger, he would go, Mom, Dad, can I have a cookie before dinner? And we'd go, no, you can't have a cookie before dinner. Which, of course, as you can expect, huge temper tantrum. I want a cookie. Why can't I have a cookie? And it occurred to me that we were trying to get him to come to our, where we wanted him to be. Instead, we reframed it and we said, you know what? Yes, you can have a cookie after you eat your dinner. If you eat your dinner, if you make everything go on this plate, gone. If you join, as parents will appreciate, the Clean Plate Club, you can have a cookie. Matter of fact, I'll even let you have two cookies. Make it really incentivized. Now, was he going to make a big scene about choking down his broccoli? Yeah. But at the end of the day, we accomplished the goal we wanted, which was eat your dinner, eat your vegetables. And he gets what he wanted, which is the cookie. And actually, we gave him twice as much. So he got 100% more than what he would have gotten. And that subtlety of the mind shift and the semantic shift of meeting him where he was and figuring out how can I get him to accomplish what I need him to do in his context, in his world, is a really, it's a simple but very powerful explanation of we've got to change the way that we approach security as you've got to do what we say instead of let's figure out how to make what you're doing a little safer.
Interesting. So what we find then is that what motivates kids, if you will, could also motivate adults. Maybe not with cookies. We don't say, hey, you know.
I don't know. I know a lot of adults that would be very, very, very happy to get a chocolate chip cookie for attending a training session.
Yeah, I've seen little stickers that says, come to the dark side. We have cookies.
Exactly.
But if you go back to your observation about the culture, and if you go back to some of the writings and things like that, Peter Drucker, who says,
yep,
culture eats strategy for breakfast. And G. Mark's corollary is culture eats policy for lunch.
Right.
And we'll find out that your strategy or your policy, if they're not aligned with your culture, it's not going to work because inertia is going to overtake that. And culture is really kind of the expectations that a group of people have from each other. So what would we do then if we're trying to create an initiative to improve our odds from a 70% failure rate to maybe a 70% or more success rate?
Well, so the first thing that we've got to do is understand that when leadership goes and asks people, what is the culture of the organization? You're probably, it's like asking a child or asking somebody like, did you do your homework? They're going to go, yeah, I did my homework. They're not going to tell, or like, what did you learn at school today? Stuff like they're not going to be very forthcoming. Part of it is truly understanding that sometimes it is good to bring somebody from the outside and say, hey, can you assess for us our like how people are doing things? It's understanding how are people actually making the decisions that they're making. So it's not that, you know, the person didn't fail to encrypt the database file because they're lazy. That's not what it is. There's some level of friction or some part of the process. Either it's not defined well, it's not like built into the workflow appropriately, it takes too much time, there's a misperception, something is in place that is causing them not to do this. It may be simply they're forgetting that that's part of the process, which means you've got to add it in as an automatic because they're not going to think about it. It's easy for us to think about the security processes, but I'll use software developers because I'm a huge fan of software developers and the work that they've got. Their job, their mandate is software works and it's available. It's released on the date it needs to be released on. Security is not part of that process in their mind. And that's fine. That's their default behavior. So the default behavior, if I, as security, want them to run SAST and DAST testing, I need to make that an automated process that's going to run without them having to do it because they're not thinking about it, they're not measured by it, and therefore there's no incentive, there's no reason for them to think about it. So that's part of it.
So let me reflect back to you. So you've got developers and they said, okay, your task, you got to get functionality and you have to have timeliness. And so from that perspective, if I go ahead from the cybersecurity perspective, well, you need to use SAS tools and your DAS tools. They're like, yeah, no, man, that's going to slow me down and I'm not going to go ahead and meet my time gates. And so as a result, at the end of the day, they do their work, the program, and they just go home. Or they go out, take a lunch break for a couple hours. And during that time, well, nothing's happening. But what can you do then to kind of change that mentality?
So very simple. You know, I worked with an organization, their developers, gave the standard, it's going to slow us down. We've got to hit a deadline. But to your point, at the end of the day, they shut their computer down, close their lid, whatever. As part of that process, it's very easy to add a line of code to say, okay, cool, send a command to the development server, run SAST and DAST. They go home, they're driving home, they're in traffic. If they're in Houston, they're in traffic for like 3 days. If they're in Atlanta, they're in traffic for like, you know, half a year. If they're in the, you know, DC area, they're trying to catch a train, which who knows when that's going to happen. But they're off doing other stuff. They're having dinner, they're taking a shower, they're playing video games, they're watching TV, they're spending time with their family. And 3 or 4 hours later, they're coming back. Why weren't you using that 3 or 4 hour process time to do something that could run in the background? So we implemented this control where, and this command, and 3-4 hours later, they come to their computer. There's this pop-up that says, here, your SAST and DAST are done. Here are the issues that you ran into. Or, hey, you've got a clean bill of health. 30 days after doing that, we asked them, how much friction was it causing in your day? And every one of them said zero. And beyond that, we actually had 3 of the people out of the 5 that we were working with say, I totally forgot it was running until I got back to my computer because I was off doing other stuff. My brain was elsewhere. There is a belief in most of the business world, there's a belief that we can multitask. We as humans cannot multitask. We do not do task changing. We do not do tasks. Like, we as humans, generally speaking, most of us need to have a task complete first before we can move to the next one. The reason that people who have, and my wife is one of them, the reason people have ADD is the people who have ADD and have those types of things, they're never feeling a sense of completion on anything, which means they're never really getting that big hit of dopamine that gives you that level of calm and happy and like fulfillment, that because they're constantly, their brain is trying to do too many things. And so that's a great example where this idea of multitasking is not the most efficient way for our brains to be running. So, but we've got so many tools at our fingertips today with AI, with machine learning, with automation, with the advanced technologies that we've got to make productivity that much better. So it's finding the ways to insert controls into the process that the user maybe never sees.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about things and people who tend to have, the foot from one thing to like, ooh, squirrel and the like. And yet what I tell people is in the cybersecurity world, sometimes that's a great asset.
Absolutely.
And what a lot of people perceive as either a weakness or a defect or a problem or as a medical condition to be treated. In the cybersecurity world, you say like, you are absolutely perfect for that. If you have the ability to, look at 20, 30 things at once, or then just go totally focused down and turn off the world, both of those skills, which are tremendously useful and not always easy to do for the average person, can create tremendous benefits in our line of work.
Absolutely. And nothing that I ever talk about, and I'm very clear about this because I talk a lot about cognitive bias. And when people hear the word bias, they have an automatic reaction to it. Nothing we're talking about here is negative. I think every one of these things is an asset somewhere. It's understanding it and really harnessing it and using it where appropriate. For example, if some of the best SOC analysts in the world that I've dealt with and that I've gotten to work with are somewhere on the autism spectrum, but they can be hyper focused and sitting down and watching a sim throw out alerts over an 8-hour period is therapeutic almost to them. They love it. If you're a threat hunter, you absolutely, being on the autism spectrum is a huge advantage because you're going to chase things down as far as you possibly can. I almost want, and I've done this before, when I look for who's going to be my incident commander during an incident response matter, I want someone who's got ADD. I want somebody who can be jumping from multiple things at once, because they can go and go, hey, Mark, Mark, I know you're doing this. Hey, Dustin, you're working on this. Hey, Ross Young, you're working on this. I can jump from person to person and come back and be okay. That's a great incident commander. You want somebody who can task shift like that. So and everything that I'm talking about, even when we're talking about end users, is understanding how humans behave, how the specific humans behave, and using that to our advantage, not in a manipulative way, but in a way to be more efficient. You know, our friend Ross Young talks all about budget and, you know, how to optimize your budget. How much of the budget that we have in our organizations is lost due to inefficiencies in processes? The answer is, if you look at the World Economic Forum, they found that decision fatigue and issues around like the inefficiency of decision making and implementation costs globally about $400 billion a year. So how much of, if you need to unlock 1, 2, 3% of your cybersecurity budget, typical cybersecurity budget being about $5 million, you can unlock $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 by making a very small change in an in the way in which you approach your strategies simply by understanding and meeting people where they are. You know, we've said for so many years, every year we get the Verizon data breach report, 85, 95, almost 100% of scenarios involve a human doing something either malicious or accidental that causes an incident. We've seen recently two instances where a major provider of internet services did something or had humans misconfigure things twice in a 2-week period that brought the internet down for a period of time. But every year the numbers are about the same, and every year we say, well, we're going to train people better. We're going to train people better. We're going to train people better. At some point we've got to go. It's not the training that's the problem. It's the strategies we're implementing are not conditioned to work in our specific environment.
So here's a thought on that one. And this is one is, so it sounds like if we have this opportunity to unlock this hidden value, if we can align that things, it almost seemed like a call for best practices. And yet I thought that would hit a nerve with you because you tend to not want to preach best practices. Why is that?
Because best practices as a concept create a belief that all I need to do is take something that somebody else has done and implement it exactly the same. And that's where the flaw in it comes. The example I always use is this. Apple, the guy who created the layout of the Apple stores, and every one of us who's listening to this, I think, has been in an Apple store at least once, even begrudgingly. There's a very specific design to them. The other one I always use is Costco. Anybody who's gone into a Costco, if you stop and think about it right now, the paper towel, water, dog food, eggs, milk, and laundry detergent are always exactly far diagonal from the front door. Why? Because you're going to have to walk through the entire store to get these essential items. And if there isn't already some Lego or toy or thing up at the front, which, by the way, that's why they put the toys up front, because the kids come in and go, Mom, Dad, I want a toy. And now you've got to deal with that. Even if you manage to get past all of that, they're going to do something really crafty. At the end of the freezer aisles, they're going to put free samples of their popular food items for you to be able to try. And the goal is, they know that in order for you to get to the back, you're going to go past a ton of stuff that you're ultimately likely going to go, oh yeah, I could get that. I really like that. I'm going to buy it. It's very strategic. The same thing with the Apple stores. The Apple stores are laid out very specifically. Well, the guy who designed that, JCPenney, saw that. And for those who are too young, JCPenney's is kind of like Walmart.
It's like a Sears. Oh, wait a minute. That doesn't work either.
Yeah. It's kind of like, imagine if Walmart was smaller, didn't have food, just clothes and like kind of essential items. That's kind of what it is. But JCPenney said, we want you to come do the exact same thing. And he did the exact same thing, designed the store the exact same way. And it failed because the makeup of the consumer that goes into a JCPenney oftentimes is different, even slightly, from an Apple store. So the point of this is, you know, bringing it to cybersecurity. When I was deputy CISO GRC, our desktop team or our endpoint team would come to me and go, we're going to be 100% compliant CIS level 2 for Windows 11. And I'd go, no, you're not. they'd go, well, why? I go, because one of the CIS benchmarks on Windows 11 is you need to set up so that passwords change every 90 days. Well, in our organization, if you are using MFA on your user account, you don't have to change your password every day.
And this 853 Bravo.
The minute you do that, you are now not, by definition, 100% compliant with CIS. You have 100% coverage of the controls, but you're not compliant with that standard anymore. You've excluded it. And all I'm saying when I say I don't like best practices is I don't like best practices because they create this mindset of blind obedience and adherence that causes more problems than it brings. If every organization were to apply every single one of the NIST 853 controls in their organization, most businesses would come to a complete halt. They would not be able to operate. There's a reason why the STIG standard for CIS, the STIG standard for CIS, is only for the upper top secret echelon of things, because it is meant to stop your organization from operating at a level that most private organizations, if not all private organizations, would not find very, very valuable.
Yeah, and for the
understanding that best practices should be a guideline, not a standard.
Yeah, a little bit of a reminder of the Pirates of the Caribbean. That's more like a guideline, right? Yeah, it's a pirate's code. It's more like a guideline. For those of us who are in this line of work, that was probably one of the best lines of the movie. It's like I can identify with that. But that's been a debate for a long, long time. Going way, way back, for those of us with some gray hair or missing some hair, I remember the old Orange Book when it came out back in the 80s. And it had the different levels, A, B, C, and D of your thing. And then if you want to get to A1, it was like one operating system that got there was SCOP, and it couldn't even get out of its own way. It was a verified design, and the whole idea was that you operated at a level that was considered an acceptable risk. Now, you're right. When you get into these super highly classified things, maybe you're handling special weapons release codes. Yeah, you want to have a lot of security on those. But for the general business, what we find out is that making a risk decision really has some pros and cons. We all accept a certain amount of risk. Otherwise, we would go out every day with an umbrella and with a jacket and with sunscreen and with a first aid kit.
I'll go a step further. And I used to use this, you know, because the statistic, and when you do a doctorate, they always tell you as part of the start of your dissertation to find that oh crap statistic. The oh crap statistic for my dissertation was humans every day, automatic and otherwise, make about 35,000 decisions a day. Now, that number includes, should I take a breath or not, which most of us don't think about, but we do tens of thousands of times a day. If we truly, wanted to de-risk ourselves as much as humanly possible, we would make one decision a day and only one decision a day, and then everything else would be automatic, which is we would decide not to get out of bed. Because if I don't get out of bed, nothing else is going to go wrong the rest of the day.
Until you see, this is a house that the tree falls on in a hurricane and goes right to the bedroom.
There is a risk with doing that for an extended period of time due to, you know, muscle atrophy and all of the, you know, health issues. But the lowest risk, you know, it's back to use another pop culture reference. It's the end of war games. It's tic-tac-toe. Sometimes the best option is not to play the game, you know, but we can't do that. So you're right. We have to take a certain level of risk. We do that every day. People forget that it is statistically riskier to drive in a car than it is to fly on an airplane.
Yeah, per unit of time. Now, if this is for a guy who this year will probably come just under 80 flights, I think it was 2019 to 114. Yeah, this guy slowed down by COVID a little bit. But yeah, you add that all up. And it also brings up some interesting questions, because I've started tracking flights back in the day when you didn't know whether your frequent flyer would give it to you. And then the little statistician in me just kept going. So I've surpassed 3,000 commercial flights that I've been counting since I started counting. And he said, well, if you had a 99% chance of landing safely, well, I'd be gone. If you had a 99.9% chance of landing safely, I'd be gone. And as a result, what we find is we make these decisions, we accept some certain amount of risk. There is a bunch of nines, but eventually it falls off. But as we look at decision-making, how do we know if we've made the right decision? Is it what we pay attention to? Is it what we don't pay attention to? Is it my book here by Don Rumsfeld in the back where I can point to the unknown unknowns and the known unknowns and things like that? What is it that makes a good decision?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because so often as humans, we focus on the outcome of the decision. Did I make the right choice? Did I invest my money in the right place? Did I, you know, plan my vacation? Like, did everything go smoothly on my vacation? That creates what kind of a variation of what's known as the Peltzman effect. And I love this one. This one is my favorite because I didn't even realize I was using it as a joke until I learned about it. And then it made it even more fun. The Peltzman effect is the idea that if I've got something creating a sense of safety, I'm more likely to take risks. The joke I used to say when I got engaged to my wife, who is a registered nurse, works in pediatric neurology, was, I'm marrying somebody who's a trained medical professional. This gives me a carte blanche to do stupid stuff every day because I've got a medical personnel who could help me out. To which she would often say, yeah, but except when I'm with you, I'm off duty. And I'm like, but are you really? But it's this idea that, you know, and we see this every day. Circus performers are willing to go out on a tightrope and walk these tightropes because there's a net below them. We say to ourselves, well, my organization is safe because we've got a firewall. You know, when we make decisions, we convince ourselves that we've made the best decision based on the information that we've got. And therefore we say, you know what? We'll often look back and go, I probably didn't make the best decision I could have. Now, if you, however, change that and look at how did I make this decision, then the outcome becomes a lot less important. It's not totally without analysis, but if you look and say, well, you know, and I'll give you a quick example here in a moment, but if we look at how did I make this decision? What criteria did I use? What was my process? Then the outcome is less important because the outcome is what it should have been. The example I give, we've all had an experience where you go to a movie or a restaurant or something based on the advice that's based on somebody else, one of your friends, family saying, this was a great movie. This was a great restaurant. And you go there and you have a horrible experience. And you're like, how could this person have thought that this would have been a movie I would enjoy? Or how could they have thought that this was a great restaurant? We made the decision because we relied on anecdotal evidence, which is fine. If you want to go to something or do something because of the review of somebody else, that's fine. But you have to acknowledge that by doing that, the risk I'm taking is results may vary. You know, not everyone's going to have the same experience. If my goal is to have the best experience possible, then anecdotal evidence is probably not the best way. I should go look at, you know, what ratings have they gotten from various sources. I should, you know, look at, does their menu have things that I want? Do they describe their atmosphere as being something I want? Is it close? Like all of the things that I'm going to need, like I need to take in as much data as I can to make that decision. Ultimately, I'm going to make the decision based on some set of criteria. It's what's known as satisficing. It's been around since the 1950s. Herbert Simon, a behavioral economist, came up with the idea and said, you know, we do things up to a point. And that makes sense because our brains can only process so much.
And it sort of sounds like the equation for compliance, because if we think about it, if we're going to spend money to get to compliance, and once we've reached compliance, you said, okay, fine, we're required to be at 90% of something. Should we keep spending money to get to 92, 93, 95, 99, 100? Well, if your goal is compliance, the answer is no. Your money's better spent doing something like it's a pure security thing that, as you had said earlier, whether or not you're following the rules and say, oh, do I have MFA or do I have this password expiration? No, I just want to make sure that I am going to have solid identity management. Right. And so as humans, we have to make all these mental shortcuts all the time. And that's where I think kind of your background. I mean, you did a poli-sci major at USF, and then an MBA in cybersecurity. And now you're, you know, Colorado Springs for Doctor of Computer Science and Cybersecurity Information. That's really, really cool. And so with all that wisdom, all that knowledge and things such as that, as we're getting close to the end of the show here, what are your thoughts? What words of insight or wisdom would you leave for our listeners, slant watchers here of CISO Tradecraft?
Focus less on the outcome and more about how you're going to get to the outcome. Because if the the GRC side of me would say, as if you follow the process, the outcome should theoretically always be the right outcome for that process. Now, you know, it's designing the process to achieve the goal you want. But if you've got strong process, if you've got good process that is focused on what your goals are, not did I get to the specific outcome, then you're gonna find that the quality of the decisions are better. And one of my kind of industry heroes in this, and I'll give just a really quick aside to it. One of my industry heroes, Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winning economist, really one of the forefathers of this school of thought, used to say that the quality of decisions determines the quality of your life. And it's a really powerful thing to think about. We don't look at the quality of our decisions. We look at the outcome, and was the outcome what I wanted? We see this in sports. You know, they'll say, well, we did everything right, it just didn't turn out our way today, or this thing went wrong. The aside I'll give you, I am a huge Daniel Kahneman fan, and I posit the fact that my dissertation was so good because the day after my dissertation was published is the day, unfortunately, that in 2024 that Daniel Kahneman passed away. My assertion is he saw my dissertation, said this is great, and said, I've done everything I can, I'm out of here. So,
and you passed the torch. Okay, but you have recorded a lot of your thoughts in your book. It's called Behavioral Insights in Cybersecurity, A Guide to Digital Human Factors. And if you give me the link, I'll make sure I put it in the show notes if somebody wants
to. Absolutely. It's available on Amazon. It is, it was so much fun to write and read back even myself. I learned things in writing the book that I had not previously known. I think there's something in there for everybody, and you've got to be open-minded enough to at least, you know, acknowledge that we're not perfect and that's okay. It's understanding how do we use our individual characteristics to our advantage in security, instead of trying to do these general things or trying to force people to do things that they're not defaulted to do.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me to wrap up here of a meme I saw just the other day. It was Captain Jean-Luc Picard talking to Data and saying something along the lines of, you can do absolutely everything right and still lose. Yeah. And that's just part of being human.
Yep.
And so what we do then is your advice, which I agree with you, is have a sound decision-making process. Follow the process, if you will. And you're going to find out that although there's some variability in there, it's not going to be a pure 2 + 2 will always give you 4. The odds are on your side. And I just finished reading a book, which I thought was quite interesting. Where is it? Yes, down here in my pile of things that I'm reading and trying to read. And the conclusion of Scott Adams, who most people know is the author of Dilbert, in his book, How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life, is he essentially says that goals are for losers, but systems are for winners. And in his example, he points out that, for example, if your goal is to lose 10 pounds, every day you're not there, you're a loser. The day you get to 10-pound loss, you win, but then after that, you have nothing further to shoot at, so you lose again. It's compared to having a system of eat right, exercise regularly, and that'll work every single day for you. And so last thought, because we've got to wrap up now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think about what you're saying about, you know, if you've got a sound decision, a sound process, you'll be, you know, you're better off. If you talk to professional blackjack players, they will actually say they play by the book. And the reason they play by the book is because, again, based on the way that the book is written, the way the rules of blackjack are, if you play by the book, you should break even. You're not going to win. You're not going to lose. You're going to walk out with the same amount you walked in with if you play by the rules, because that's the way the system is designed. Same thing. Every decision you make, if you've got a sound decision process behind it, you will break even and have a better shot of profiting from the decision than you would if you try to go at it without a sound decision process.
Well, got it. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dustin Sachs. Thank you for being part of CISO Tradecraft. Thank you for the wonderful insights. If people want to learn more about that, look for his book, Behavioral Insights in Cybersecurity, available on Amazon or other locations as well. We hope that you found the show of value to you. And if so, go ahead and let other people know. And then give us a thumbs up or 5-star. Not that we're grade grubbing, but it helps us appear higher in search terms. And also, if you're not doing so already, follow us on LinkedIn. We have more than a podcast. We've got a Substack newsletter. We have regular information that comes out that we help your cybersecurity journey professionally and hopefully personally as well. So thank you for your time and attention. This is your host, G. Marcardi. Until next time, stay safe out there.